Kia rana. This is Tangatoa Te Moana from RNZ Pacific. I'm Don Wiseman, and this week, the horrific violence in Papua New Guinea and the role played by politicians. Turtle wars in a Pacific paradise. The Pacific got no deal at the WTO meeting, but at least one NGO says it was a lucky escape. The Pacific continues to dominate lists for the most obese nations in the world, and Pacific Fest is back on. Papua New Guinea police have arrested 15 people in connection with a massacre in Anga province last month. That's according to local media. In an interview with RNZ Pacific's Lydia Lewis, one of those who claimed to be one of the killers involved in the massacre has revealed that mercenaries are collecting bullets for the next revenge attack, despite the government issuing more powers to the military.
This is the sound of the guns being used in a show of power ahead of the attack that killed more than 70 people. And this is a tribesman translating for one of the men hired to kill.
He has used gun and ammunition to kill 10 people. This is what he's telling me now.
That's 10 people apparently killed by one man on what's been called Bloody Sunday. And the attacks have not stopped there. A video has been circulating on social media platforms of what appears to be a young boy pleading for his life. The video seen by RNZ Pacific shows the child being hit by a machete until he falls to the ground. The man who says he's responsible was introduced to us by a tribesman via video chat.
This is the Ironman. If they put 2,000 kina for him and say go and bend at a village, he goes with groups. And then kill the village, clear the village. They give him money, he took it and go to his village.
The so-called hire man stands slouched over, holding a machete. He looks at the camera and recounts how he killed a child he believed was on the enemy side. The tribesman translates.
He was using bush knife to cut a guy there, small guy. And he was feeling really bitterness on his heart and he's got bush knife and cut that boy, he's saying.
The tribesman says the child was killed with a machete because the gunmen have run out of bullets.
They are already collecting bullets. The other side are getting ready for bullet and the other side are ready for bullet. The other side have killed numbers and we kill on the other side a bit.
Many Ingans have lamented that the traditional rules of war have been ignored as children have not been spared in the conflict and societal norms that governed their society have been broken. A woman who was kidnapped last year in Hala, in the Bosavi region, a different area to where the recent massacre took place, and held for ransom, Kathy Alex says PNG is on the verge of being a failed state.
If we look at indicators that shows that a failed state, we're already in it. We're losing values. The core of this nation is values. Values that all societies together. Tumbunablu imi olim velilong. You come out lo tumbunablu sign.
When asked if shooting people is the only way, this was the tribesman's response.
Yes, yes, that's the only way. Because we don't have proper government to protect us from enemies. In order to protect ourselves, houses and assets, we have to buy guns in order to protect them. We are living in the isolated areas. Because when they come and shoot, I'll have to use guns to shoot them.
Wabinamanda community leader Akila Kunza says mediation is underway between the warring factions in the remote highlands to prevent further violence. Mr. Kunza translated the words of a woman who was at one of the meetings.
Many died and they will be missing in the village. Houses were burnt down.
She says she walked 20 hours on foot with 7 children to flee the violence. Just over 2 weeks on, like many, she's still displaced.
Now, the man being touted by the opposition as the next leader of Papua New Guinea says the first thing his administration would do is put more focus on law and order. The governor of East Sepik province, Alan Bird, has been put forward as the opposition's candidate for prime minister with a vote of no confidence, likely, in the last week of May. Mr. Bird's realistic about his chances, but he told me what he aspires to do.
Well, I think the first thing we would do is just restructure the budget and put more focus on things like law and order. Bring that right to the top and deal with it quickly.
This law and order issue, and I know this was something that you'd been delegated to look at after the violence following the election, and it's a huge problem for your country, isn't it? It's going to take gazillions of dollars to resolve it all.
Not necessarily. Currently, it's confined to the Upper Highlands part of the country, but it is filtering down to Port Moresby and other places. And I guess the reluctance to deal with the violence is that I'd say 90% of that violence stems from the aftermath of the elections. From our own findings, we know that many leaders in that part of the world that run for elections actually use these warlords to help them get elected. And obviously, they've got like 4 years of downtime between elections, and this is how they spend their spare time. So it's hardly surprising. I mean, I think our military and our police have the capability to deal with these criminal warlords and to put them down, how shall I say it, with extreme prejudice. But, you know, you get a lot of interference in the command of the police and the Defence Force, I suspect, that changes their operational orders once they get too close to dealing with these terrorists.
Well, the government, and when you were part of it, initiated this process of allowing police to act with lethal force. I don't know if that's actually happened at this point or not, but are they the solutions? A lot of commentators would say the problems here are to do more with the lack of money, the lack of opportunity, the lack of education.
You know, the lack of education, opportunity and things like that will play a small part. But again, as I said, you know, I come from a province where we don't have warlords running around heavily armed to the teeth. I mean, you've got to remember, an AR-15 or an M4 or anything like that, these things on the black market cost around 60,000 to 70,000 kina. I mean, that's probably what, 20,000 to 25,000 New Zealand dollars? The ordinary Papua New Guinean cannot afford one of those things. And guns are banned in Papua New Guinea, and they've been banned for like 30 years. So how do these weapons get in? Just buying a bullet to operate one of these things is hard enough. So you've got to ask yourself the question, how are illiterate people with perhaps no opportunity, as you put it, able to come into possession of such weapons? Well, we understand they even have things like MAC 58s, which are 50 caliber chain-fed machine guns. How do they get these things? And, you know, I mean, one of those would probably cost about, you know, 30,000 or 40,000 New Zealand dollars to purchase in the first place anyway.
The esteemed military leader, Jerry Singerock, compiled at the request of the government about 15 years ago a substantial report on what to do about the gun problem. But next to nothing, I think, of that has ever been implemented. Would you go back to something like that?
Absolutely. I have a lot of respect for General Singerock, and I know him personally as well. And him and I have had these discussions on occasion. And that's the thing. You've got smart, capable people who have done a lot of work in areas such as this, and we just simply put them on the back burner and let them collect dust.
All right, well, let's look at this upcoming vote then. Have you got the numbers, do you think?
Well, look, obviously we're talking with people inside the government because that's where the numbers are. Hence, we've been encouraged to go ahead with the vote of no confidence. The chances of me being Prime Minister per se is probably like 5%. So it could be someone else. You know, I say that because in Papua New Guinea, it's really difficult for someone with my background and my sort of discipline and level of honesty to become PM. It's happened a couple of times in the past, but it's very rare.
You're too honest.
I'm too honest, yes.
Okay. We've looked at the law and order issue. What else needs fixing fast?
Well, look, we've got a youth bulge. We've got a huge population problem. So we've got to start looking at practical ways in terms of how we can quickly expand opportunities, to use your word. So whatever we've been doing for the last 10 years has not worked. So we've got to try something new. And my proposal is actually really keeping with international management best practice. I mean, you go to any organization, this is what they do. I think New Zealand does it as well, and Australia does it, which is you've got to push more funds and responsibilities closer to the coalface. And that's the provinces. If I could do one thing that would change the trajectory of this country, it's actually to push more resources away from the centralized government. We actually have a centralized system of government right now. The Prime Minister has so much control to the point where it's up to him to authorize the building of a road in a particular place worth, say, 5 million kina. So the national government is, or the federal government, if you like, is looking after projects that are as low as, say, 2 to 3 million New Zealand dollars in value, all the way up to projects that are $500 million in value. So the question is, there's got to be better separation of powers, better separation of responsibilities, and of course, clearly demarcated roles and responsibilities. Right now, we're all competing for the same space. It's highly inefficient. We're duplicating a lot of things, and there's a lot of wastage of resources. The way to do that is to decentralize, really.
What's your feeling about the MPs having direct control over significant amounts of these funds that are meant to go to their electorates? Should they?
Well, I don't think any of us should have access to direct funding in that regard. However, this is the prevailing political culture that we live in. So, again, coming back to my idea about ensuring that we get better funding at subnational levels is to strengthen the operational capability of the public servants there so that once they start to perform, then hopefully over time, there'll be less of a need to directly give funds to members of parliament because the system itself will start functioning. We've killed the system over the last, 20 or 30 years. And so now the system is overly dependent on one individual, which is wrong.
About 70 to 80% of adults in Tonga, American Samoa and Nauru are obese. It was revealed in a study on worldwide trends in underweight and obesity published by the Lancet Medical Journal. The highest rates of obesity in the world are for women in Tonga and American Samoa, and for men, American Samoa and Nauru. Pacifica Health leader, Auckland University's Sir Colin Tukuitonga, told Caleb Fotheringham there's no easy fix to address obesity.
It's a long-standing issue. This study is an ongoing study done at UCL, the University College London, with WHO, and has been going on for some years. In the 70s, some researchers pointed out for the first time the problems of diabetes and obesity, primarily in Nauru, related to their wealth at the time and changed consumption patterns with imported food items. But pretty much since then, it's just taken off and it doesn't appear to be declining at all in the islands, despite the best efforts of many people. So in overall human terms, is a recent phenomenon directly related to the change in diets from traditional fresh fish and locally grown crops to imported highly processed food items, flour and rice and tin fish and so on. So the study has been monitoring trends for some years, and this was referring to the period 1997 to 2022, I think it was. So the findings are not a surprise in many ways.
Do you have any ideas of what can be done to help reduce the rates of obesity?
With great difficulty. If we knew the answer, I wouldn't be talking to you, Kayla, but we're making a ton of money. This is the challenge many people have, of course. In simple terms, you could say, encourage people in the islands to go back to planting and consuming local crops and catching fish and eating fresh and avoiding imported food items. But of course, imported food items is now a big part of the diets of many islands, and it's not easy to reverse. Those countries you mentioned, Nauru, for example, import well over 90% of what they eat. The same in American Samoa and Tonga. So it's closely related to trade in processed food. So you could argue if you turn that off or modify that, theoretically, you could reverse the trend. The problem, of course, is that people are finding all of these food items convenient, more affordable in many ways because local crops can be expensive. So what's needed is deliberate attempt by island nations to act across all the sectors, for example, reduce trade or have some kind of disincentive taxes, for example, on food items and soft drinks, as well as policies that encourage and support local communities to grow their own.
I know in the Cook Islands, they have a sugar tax there, and I'm not too sure about other Pacific Island nations, but I imagine some do. Is that successful?
Yes, at least 14 of the small islands have imposed a sugar tax on soft drink. There's some pretty good studies out of Tonga, which shows the increased tax on soft drinks reduces consumption, but also correlated with that was increased consumption of water. So there's no doubt that taxes on soft drinks have an effect. It does reduce consumption. But in and of their own, of course, it's not enough, because the other side of this equation is people get off their devices and get more active, which doesn't appear to have happened. Pretty much most island nation populations have become quite sedentary and not as active as they used to be. Some evidence in the Cook Islands of increased physical activity, particularly in women, through community dance classes, that kind of thing. But again, not enough to really affect the change.
I imagine other countries, not just Pacific Island countries, went through a similar thing of growing their own food and then importing. Is something unique about the Pacific Island nations that means their obesity issues is actually worse than, I don't know, maybe some other countries that have done a similar shift from growing their own to importing foods?
Well, the Lancet article pointed out that in the Middle East and North Africa, obesity rates are also very high. And in those places, I understand, again, they've moved away from traditional crops to imported food items. There doesn't appear to be anything particularly unique in the islands compared to other parts of the world. I mean, the Caribbean has similar issues. Parts of the African continent have similar issues. So it's not unique as such. Although I was a co-chair of a WHO high-level report on non-communicable diseases in small island states, and it's clear that in the small island developing states, NCDs appear to be disproportionately more of a problem compared to other parts of the world, and some of that is correlated with obesity and the food systems and reduced physical activity levels we just talked about. So nothing unusual in the islands, but the impact of NCDs appear to be disproportionately higher in small island states like the Pacific.
Is that because obesity is worse, or is it the same and there's something else going on?
Mostly related to the prevalence of obesity, and in your intro you referred to Tonga and American Samoa, Nauru, you know, two-thirds, three-quarters of the adult population are obese. It's mostly related to the prevalence of obesity.
And just in New Zealand, I read that you said that two-thirds of young Pacific girls are obese, and that's an increasing trend in terms of childhood obesity in New Zealand. Has that been a long-standing issue, or is that a bit of a newer one?
Oh, it's not new. Successive health surveys show that Pacific Island young women, girls, adolescents, have had highest rates of obesity in overweight and obesity in New Zealand. Also, young boys, say compared to Pākehā kids. So that's not new, but obviously the trend is for a continuing increase. And in fact, most of the young Pacific Island young ladies, adolescent women, are either overweight or obese.
I imagine if you're a child and you're obese, you'll continue that trend when you get older, is that right?
Yes, obese child makes for an obese adult. That's pretty well established. And people are talking about trying to intervene pre-pregnancy, before mums become pregnant, to try to modify their diet, and also monitor weight gain during pregnancy, closely monitor weaning food, encourage breastfeeding for as long as possible. So if you're an obese child, you're more likely to be an obese adult.
A fractious meeting of world trade ministers in Abu Dhabi ended last weekend with little to show for the time and money spent. Pacific Islands were seeking at the WTO ministerial meeting to have the governments of the larger fishing nations stop or reduce the subsidies they pay out. This didn't happen, but a spokesman for PANG, that's the Pacific Network on Globalisation, Adam Wolfenden, told me this is a better result than having a substandard deal foisted on them, which had been the prospect right up to the end of the meeting.
No, and it's not for lack of effort. And I think we've seen that was put on the table, the text that on, particularly on fishery subsidies, that was on offer right up until the last minute. There were still quite a few holes in it that, you know, from I think Pang's perspective needed to be fixed for a deal that was met that would fulfill the promises of these negotiations. While that fell apart, and I think that there's some positives within that, it's not for want of effort. You know, and in particular, the Pacific did a lot of negotiating and really fought a fight to try and get an outcome that held those big distant water fishing fleets in particular to account, like called for a standstill and a reduction in those subsidies.
And this is something that the UN, through its sustainable development goals, says is a must, that these subsidies must go.
That's right. And I think what we were disappointed in, the way the negotiations went, was that the prohibitions, so those rules that were going to dictate how those subsidies would be cut, were so watered down and were so weak for particularly those countries who could meet the sort of the thresholds that were being asked around proving your fishing sustainable, or the approach to distant water fishing. By the end, it was very much try your best to not make these subsidies. Our opinion on that was that that's a complete failure of the mandate. You know, the mandate was saying you need to prohibit these subsidies that contribute to overfishing and overcapacity. And what was on the table for the big fishing fleets failed that completely.
So essentially what the Pacific was looking for never even made it onto the agenda.
Well, what came onto the agenda that the Pacific would have been happy with was what they proposed. And they came to these ministerial with a strong proposal to explicitly come up with a mechanism to make the subsidies, particularly for distant water fishing, come to a standstill and then, you know, reduce within a certain amount of time. So they were very clear in what they were asking for and explicit that this had to have an impact on the subsidies. And, you know, this was, I think, heavily contested by a lot of the big fishing nations because, you know, it's very much in their interest to not have that come into effect. So what we ended up seeing was a text that was circulated that largely gave those big fishing nations a number of options to get out of it. So there was a few mechanisms that they could access that would effectively be loopholes for them anyway. And so in that instance, it became very much something that they could live with. In the end, it became a bit of a political question for some of those big countries, and we ended up in a situation where there wasn't an outcome.
Pacific nations earn a lot of money these days from fishing licenses. Why is it so important to them that there's an end to these subsidies?
Yeah, that's a really good question because, well, there's two parts to that, particularly within these talks. And the first is a lot of overfishing of fish stocks, you know, that might happen outside of what's permitted or in the high seas, comes from the subsidies for these big vessels. It's not profitable for them to fish so far away from home without at least some support. And so cutting those subsidies would help both in terms of limiting their ability to catch more than they're allowed, but also it opens up the prospect for Pacific countries at some point, and we know some of them have a particular plan for increasing their own domestic fishing capacity at like an industrial scale. And, you know, when you have your own boats fishing your own resources, the economic benefits for that are far greater than if you're paying someone else or someone else is coming in, taking the fish and taking it elsewhere. And so we see these subsidies play into that. And it's all part of the ability of these countries, the Pacific countries in particular, to be able to, you know, when they're ready, start to develop their own fleet.
So on the matter of fishing, no agreement of any substance at the WTO meeting. Where to from here?
Yeah, so there's no agreement at all, and it's going to be sent back to Geneva, where the WTO is based, and it's still a bit unclear exactly what gets taken back from this meeting. There was a proposed text that was brought to the ministerial. We know there was another one that got circulated during the ministerial, but at the moment there's little clarity on what the next step is in terms of what are they going to be negotiating specifically when they're back in Geneva. And there's still the mandate to conclude this. There's still a process that, you know, allows them to do it. It just, they didn't get it done in the United Arab Emirates. And so it's back to Geneva and potentially back to some kind of drawing board. It's not clear exactly what just yet.
Yes. Now, one of the people working alongside you there in Abu Dhabi has been Emeritus Law Professor from New Zealand, Jane Kelsey. She has this hope that the failure of yet another ministerial will generate an overdue recognition that the neoliberal agenda of the WTO is past its use-by date. How likely is that?
I don't think it's particularly likely in the short term, but I think some of the issues that have been exposed at this ministerial, I think, speak to some fundamental tensions and challenges that the WTO is really grappling with. And I think if we were to look at the fisheries subsidies agreement, so the one that got agreed last ministerial and even the negotiations this time, the way that the WTO attempts to deal with some issues like sustainability or like complex issues around fisheries or even climate change, it starts to hit a real wall because it seems compelled to approach them in a way that is solely focused in creating a better business environment. So lowering import taxes, lowering the ability of governments to regulate services. It becomes problematic with that is that sometimes these sustainability issues that they're trying to resolve, they're using the same tools that caused the problem to try and solve it. And I think for the WTO, there's a real reckoning that needs to happen internally around how this kind of an ideological approach to all problems needs to be understood as also causing those problems. So, you know, the problems are no longer the solutions. And I think in Professor Kelsey's comment, speaking to a lot of fundamental truths that I think the WTO hopes to avoid, but are becoming quite a reckoning for them.
A turtle tour owner in Cook Islands says he has not signed the latest safety agreement between operators because it's inadequate. The majority of turtle tour operators have agreed to new safety and environmental standards with Cook Islands Tourism. But Snorkel Cook Islands owner Josh Utanga is not convinced. He says he wants restrictions on boat use around swimmers in Avarua Passage to be added. However, Cook Islands Tourism says Pacific Snorkel Cook Islands didn't sign up because the business is unable to agree to all the safety and environmental standards, including the requirement of a 1-to-4 guide-to-client ratio. The latest MOU comes after a New Zealander died in the passage in December when he went snorkelling alone. Caleb Fotheringham spoke to Mr. Utanga about the agreement.
It's not what's in the MOU, it's what's missing from the MOU. I would just like to see them take more of a proactive approach rather than a reactive approach. So my main point is obviously the use of boats in that skinny channel. At the moment, there's only 3 operators using the boats, but let's think proactively here. What's stopping 15 operators using the boats? What's stopping Captain Tumblers coming and dropping a big glass bottom boat in the middle of it? So it's just like, if you're going to include these types of what they're trying to get them across the line as safety vessels, like you obviously don't need 15 safety vessels in a passage. Where does it end? You know, are they thinking about the consequences? Are they thinking down the track 5-10 years time and how they're going to look after this precious stretch of water, and how is it going to be sustainable from a business point of view, from an environmental point of view, and from a safety point of view? How is it going to be sustainable 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the track? Obviously, my biggest concern at the moment is like the boats in such close proximity to bathing swimmers in the water. I know in Australia and New Zealand, you know, you're not allowed within 60 meters of a bathing swimmer unless you're a rescue craft such as an IRB or a jet ski. And they obviously use them in rescue situations only. At the moment, these operators, yes, they are only taking small groups of 12 to 16 packs per tour, but they're trying to fit like 3 or 4 tours into one tide. So therefore, they need to taxi their guests in quickly so they can get the next guests out there. You know, there's been too many times where they're like whistling and yelling at swimmers in the water to move out of the way so they can quickly taxi their guests in, which is not the right protocols, because a bathing swimmer in the water always has right of way over a motorboat. So that's where it grinds my gears a little bit, where they're trying to say they're used as safety vessels, because it's not the ideal safety vessel, because you can't actually maneuver quick enough to be used as a safety vessel when you've got so many swimmers in the water. I know that we've been accused of overcrowding the passage with 40 packs or so. I guess my argument to that is, like, if they're not coming with us, they're going to be going with somebody else, and then we're opening up the door for more and more operators. So sure, I am trying to obviously have our market share and protect our market share, and that's why we've sort of adapted to this lifeguarded area operating model.
You may have seen, but Cook Islands Tourism, they said the reason that you didn't sign the MOU was because of your business model.
It's totally incorrect, matey. Like, our business model can actually fit in with the whole MOU, 1-4 and everything. Like, this morning we had 24 packs and I had 7 guards on, mainly because I did have a school group, which is becoming more and more prevalent for us. We're getting a lot of school groups through Adventure Tours in New Zealand, and I think tomorrow we have a new school travel organisation that's joining us. And these types of clientele, they're wanting a RAMS form, they're wanting to know our health and safety standards, and obviously I can provide that with my whole background. I'm all about the health and safety, but the one thing I can't guarantee for them is the external risks and hazards that these other operators are adding to an already dangerous stretch of water.
Eleven Pacific Island nations are being represented at this weekend's Pacifica Festival in Auckland. The annual event, for a long time one of Auckland's hallmark events, is offering world-class cultural performances, traditional soul food, indigenous arts and crafts, and much more. Tiana Haxton spoke to the major event group manager, Jep Savali, and asked him what the festival is all about.
That's a great question. It's the pride. We're arguably living in the capital of Polynesia of the world, with up to 300,000 people that hail from, you know, the Pacific. And so it's an opportunity for us to take a section of each of those villages and communities that are represented here in Aotearoa to really bring them to life through these cultural performances, through their art, through their craft, through food and through fashion.
What really goes on behind the scenes to get such a festival like this off the ground?
So I want to acknowledge the Pacific Village Charitable Trust, who Tautaki Auckland Unlimited partner with. They're a very large part of the planning and preparation over what is essentially 12 months worth of planning. And with them, we plan what this festival might look like. There's a theme that goes with the festival. For this year, the second festival back from COVID. And so with that, we're really excited to be able to showcase again what Tamaki Makaurau and audiences around Auckland are used to, but also some new things that we're doing with the Auckland Pacifica Festival. So we're in a phase, evolution of Pacifica Festival. And I think it's a good thing to be able to be agile and manage change in this way. For us, though, at the heart of this festival is our Pacifica community. And that's at the core. And the value of our festival is being able to showcase our communities and celebrate them to the world.
And that is Tangata o Te Moana. It's come to you from RNZ Pacific. If you'd like to find out more, you can check our website at rnzi.com.